We'll call the House Tax Committee to order. The hour of 10:15 having arrived. Members, we have, or I should say member, oh no, members, members, we have a couple things on the agenda today. First of all, we're going to complete the presentation from Dr. Paul Wilson from the Department of Revenue, and then we will be having a presentation from our own Tax Committee member, Representative Downey, regarding House File 1216. There will be no votes on it other than possibly, I believe we have a delete all to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. So I think what we'll do, members, is we're going to recess to a time certain, 10:20, until we get some members in, because I want everyone to hear Dr. Wilson's presentation. So we are in recess until 10:20.
But I'll show it to you after.
Yeah. But it's not good because they have to fix that.
Then you'd only get 10%.
Well, that's what you do.
All right, I'll take a look at it.
They want to force them to take it away.
Oh,
yeah, Bonnie, being that you're the sixth, how far back does the first or the senior go?
I'm pretty sure it. 70s.
Morning.
So if there's a little bit further, maybe like really, right. My dad's actually working on reconstructing that.
Well, he needs to think.
And then there's been every single generation.
There's two that skip a number. So my dad doesn't have a number, and then my great grandfather didn't have them either.
But they were
Robert Patrick's, yeah. So really, I'm the eighth.
Oh, the sixth is.
Right, yeah, we didn't contiguously number, so it skipped the number. So my grandfather was the fifth, and I'm the sixth.
We've got four generations of Linda Carlson, but there's been times when the middle name is different. My father was Lyndon C, and I'm Lyndon R.S. I've got two middle names.
Okay.
And my son is Lyndon R.S., but his son is named for his great-grandfather, so he's Lyndon C.
Gotcha.
So technically, he's Lyndon Carlson II.
Right.
When you skip the letter.
Right. I was very upset today. I found out that there's no rules about this. You can just do whatever you want. There shouldn't be rules about this.
There are rules if you're in Royal, but yes, in England.
You got 20 seconds.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Were you one that was paired?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're paired with?
And
which one of you has the most of
it's not formally in your name, but there's
everything. So where most of his district is currently, he's got that.
We will call the House Tax Committee meeting to order. Coming out of recess, we do have a quorum. Representative Coonan moves the minutes of February 22nd. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Coonan. We're very fortunate today to have with us the Randolph FFA crew that will be observing committee today. And it's home of Randolph, the Mighty Rockets, I believe. Is that correct?
Go Rockets.
Home of the Mighty Rockets. Okay. With that, we're very fortunate today to have Dr. Paul Wilson with us. What we're doing, members, again, as you remember, Dr. Wilson had started a presentation on the 2012 tax expenditure report. We did run out of time. This is a very important report, and so we would like Dr. Wilson to pick up from where he was and finish his presentation. Then we'll go to the Downey bill, not for votes, but for a presentation from Representative Downey on House File 1216. Dr. Wilson, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and continue your presentation.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Paul Wilson, Director of the Tax Research Division at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Members of the committee, you had a copy of the slides, so you may still have it. I don't know that there are any additional copies if you don't, but I will continue. Basically, I'll be starting on page 6 of the slides, although I want to look at one slide first. But page 6 of that handout is basically where I'll be starting. I do have another handout that we may have time to talk about somewhat that has got a ton of numbers on it. It ties into some of these slides and may be useful. It may be handed out now, but I won't be talking about that now. So in some ways, I don't want to divert your attention from the slides that we're going through. We talked last time about, I gave some introductory remarks about the tax expenditure budget. I tried to sort of say I was going to talk about three different perspectives, three ways of looking at the tax expenditure budget. One is the budget perspective, which says it's to improve budgeting by sort of allowing easier evaluation because it puts numbers in front of people, what these things, how much money is involved in these tax expenditures. It's sort of a one-on-one, one-by-one. You compare a tax expenditure with other ways of doing the same thing, or you look at and evaluate tax expenditures on a one-by-one basis. I want to really start today, though, talking about the tax reform perspective. The tax reform perspective goes back. The way to think about it is it's really what Ronald Reagan did in the mid-80s, which was to say we can expand the base and drop the rate. And so the tax reform perspective sort of looks at doing a lot at once. It's sort of looking at not just one by one, but sort of looking and saying, can we do something to expand the base and drop the rate? And I'm going to be talking about this as revenue neutral, which was close to what it was at that time. But obviously, if you change revenue, you could still call that tax reform. But I'm sort of looking at revenue neutral tax reform, where you're broadening the base and dropping the rate. And how would the tax expenditure budget be helpful in that discussion? And then the third perspective I won't say much about, but I have some cautions about using this as a this study as a menu for taxing for ways to raise revenue, and I want to make some cautions there that won't come up in the earlier slides. So at the top of page 6 of the handout, tax reform perspective. If you want to broaden the tax base and lower the rates, a lot of people start by saying let's add up all the tax expenditures, for say income tax, add them all up, and that'll broaden the base a lot, and we can reduce the tax rate a lot because we've got so much broader base. We have never shown totals in our study for adding up tax expenditures because for a number of reasons why we don't think the totals are as useful or why they can be misleading. And I'll explain why some of them are misleading. On the other hand, I'm going to add them up today. So I have a handout that adds them up. There are problems with adding them up, but I think it still is useful as long as you know of some of the cautions. I want to give you three cautions about, for income tax, looking at the tax expenditure budget as a way to broaden the base and lower the rate. And the three cautions are basically saying you can't really do as much as it looks like, okay, for several reasons. Three reasons for caution. Number one, the repeal of some tax expenditures would significantly increase complexity in our tax code. The reason for that is that Minnesota piggybacks on many federal provisions that affect the timing of taxes. Things like accelerated depreciation and decoupling from federal law for those items would require businesses keep two sets of books, and often for a long time. We decoupled from federal depreciation in the early 80s. If you have 30-year property, I'm not quite sure if that was effective, but if you got 30-year property, you got two sets of books for 30 years, where you'd have to have different accounting for the state tax than you do for federal tax. And so there's a real advantage when you affect, when you have timing issues that are going to affect taxes over a long period of time. There's a real advantage to conforming to the federal handling of those. Even if you don't think the federal handling is ideal in the way the federal tax budget does it, there's the simplicity advantages of that are why we often say we want to conform to federal changes in the timing provisions. That's almost the highest priority for the Department of Revenue when we are conforming to federal law. And examples here, accelerated depreciation, deferred compensation, pension contributions, IRAs. There are tax expenditures for each of those in the tax expenditure budget. If the federal government changed its way of handling these, we could go along and actually those estimates would be good estimates. But federal tax reform is different than state tax reform, and our hands are tied a little more due to the complexity of our separating ourselves. So timing issues is the first thing, and basically I would say the timing issues are at least going to raise enough administrative problems that you might want to just dismiss them or at least consider them carefully. So that's a group of tax expenditures that maybe you can't broaden the base very easily with to drop the rate. The second caution is related, because sometimes if we repeal tax expenditures, we will actually have compliance problems or informational problems. If there's an item that's in the tax expenditure budget, but it's not taxed federally, it's an exemption, exclusion from federal tax, taxable income, it's not reported anywhere in the federal tax return, and it's not subject to federal reporting requirements, and it's not aligned on our tax return already, then the taxpayer may not know what the amount would be, and we may not be able to enforce taxing that item. It doesn't mean you can't do this, but it says the informational problems are fairly severe on some of these. Fringe benefits are often the biggest example of this. They're excluded from income. They don't show up on your W-2. They don't show up anywhere. We don't have any reporting, so we're not going to get 1099 on most of those. And as a result, if we try to tax that, we either would have to have employers report it to us, or we'd have to depend upon taxpayers sort of voluntarily compliance with no real good way to audit for it or check on it. An example of this, again, mostly fringe benefits. There are a few fringe benefits that actually are reported on a W-2. Those we could get information on, but most fringe benefits that are non-taxable, we would have a hard time taxing for informational reasons. Now, again, you could pass a law to do it, but just realize there are administrative difficulties here as well. If the federal government starts taxing a fringe benefit, we can do it too without any administrative problems. But if it doesn't get taxed by them, it creates some problems for us. And the third caution is there are interactions between tax expenditures. So if you repeal multiple itemized deductions, for example, you'll raise less than the sum of the estimates you find in the tax expenditure budget. If you take the simple sum of the six, maybe it's seven, the six itemized deductions that are in the tax expenditure budget, if you take the estimates of the cost of those tax expenditures and you just add them up, you get $766 million. I think this is in fiscal year 2013. You get a total of $766 million. But if you actually repealed all of them and said we're not going to get any itemized deductions at all, a lot of people move into the standard deduction fairly quickly, and you can't get any more money from them once they get to the standard deduction. So when you do a lot of them, you raise less than when you do them individually, less than the sum of when you do them individually. We can run that. The adjustment for interactions is that you would raise $245 million less if you did all of them. And so you really get 521. So if you add these things up, you're going to overstate, in this case, substantially the amount of revenue that is the amount of base expansion that is really there. So three reasons. Timing may be problematic for us and for taxpayers. Information will be problematic if there's informational problems. And third, interactions. Now, this is probably the most important interaction. We can adjust for this, and I have adjusted for this in where I'm going with the rest of this presentation. But other interactions are probably, some are positive, some are negative. This is the big negative that that you definitely would want to adjust for, and it is, this number is actually given in the tax expenditure budget in the introduction, but not, it isn't put into the pages you would look at for the numbers. So, where does that leave us? This slide may be a little troubling to some, so I will start with what isn't troubling. In red, the tax expenditure total, if you add up all the tax expenditures for income tax that are in the tax expenditure budget for tax year, for fiscal year 2013, in millions of dollars is what it shows there. That's 12, it's about, it's in red, $4.7 billion. If you just add them all up, you get $4.7 billion. However, and that's adjusted for the interactions on itemized deductions, the third point I talked about. However, 71% of that money is coming from provisions that either are timing issues or you would have trouble with information if we actually tried to repeal. So 71% of that is very troublesome administratively. Now, again, I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying you've got to think about whether that is really possible, if that is administratively possible, if you even wanted to do it. How do you effectively do it? If you take those out, you're left with only $1.3 or $1.4 billion. That first number is 57% of collections. The collections number is in blue at the bottom. So we collect $8.3 billion. That's the forecast for fiscal year 2013. Tax expenditures are $4.7 billion. If you just add those two together, you get $13 billion of potential tax base. But 71% of that increase has some difficulty with it. If you only do the parts that pose fewer or no administrative problems, you've only got 29% expansion in the base, basically. And if you expand the base by 29%, you could drop the rate not to 5%, which the top rate. If I drop the rates proportionally, you couldn't get to 5%, which is what it looks like with 57% base expansion. You can only get to about 6.75%. And that's getting rid of everything that is sort of easy to get rid of. All itemized deductions, tax all Social Security income, tax all no tax exempt bond interest. I mean, so it's getting rid of all of those. About half of the money here is from itemized deductions. And I think the real message here on the income tax is that because we're looking at state tax reform, not federal tax reform, we are really limited much more. Federal tax reform, broadening the base and lowering the rate, you can do a lot. You can do quite a bit here, but it's more limited than what you may think of when you just look at the sum. Now, that's the message for income tax. What about the corporate tax? Corporate tax is very different. Oh, I should go back. Just mention the number at the top of this, the $13 billion, that's the number I thought might be troubling. That's sort of saying if we got rid of everything, how much would we get? And that's put on here at the suggestion of the Tax Expenditure Review Commission. They liked that kind of number, and they wanted us to sort of show what the potential gross revenue was, subtract the tax expenditures, and get what's left. But it's really the red and blue numbers I'm focusing on here, not adding them together at this point. Corporate tax is very different because for corporate tax, our collections are about $890 million. That's the forecast. Tax expenditures are $828 million. That's 93% of collections. So the tax expenditures we have are 93% of collections, and 85% of those have no timing problems and no informational problems for us. They have big problems for taxpayers. In other words, individual income tax has a lot of those. They're not that important for the corporate tax. So in corporate tax, there really is a tremendous ability to broaden the base and drop the rate if you're looking at that as a tax reform. Now, there still are some. So rather than 93%, you can only broaden the base by about 79%. And that is doing everything. And believe me, no one really wants to do all of that. Okay, this would include moving away from 100% sales apportionment, for example. That would not be administratively difficult for us, but that may be something that parties have sort of been united in moving toward 100% apportionment. So realize this is doing a lot. This is not easy. But you do have 79% of collections, and if you in fact took that and you did all of that $703 million, you could drop the rate to about 5.5%. Now, I have heard a member of the other legislative body talk about getting the rates down a lot lower than that, and all I can say is, I think this is about as far as you can go. I don't know quite how you go further than that unless something happens at the federal level to do more. So base bonding has the potential to reduce rates from 9.8% to roughly 5.5% without decoupling from federal timing provisions, depreciation, et cetera. So individual income tax is different than corporate tax. You've got a lot more potential there in corporate tax to broaden the base. And I do have the handout that I don't want to talk about yet, but the handout I'll look at briefly, and it actually goes through each of these and puts them into categories, and you can sort of see which ones we're talking about if you wanted to look at them later. Sales tax is the last tax I want to talk about. Broaden the base, drop the rate. Is that feasible? How much can you do? How low can you get the rate? Tax expenditure budget gives you numbers that are useful in doing that, but again, there are two cautions. The first caution is the tax expenditures include a lot, and include any we count as a tax expenditure and put the numbers in the budget, tax expenditure budget, for any non-taxable sale of tangible personal property or services to the final user. Now, that's not the only way to define tax expenditures, okay? There's not a federal tax expenditure budget for sales tax, and states do this differently, but we have, from the very beginning of our tax expenditure budget, said any exemption for a final purchaser, not inputs that are used up in production, but a good that's purchased by the final purchaser, that is counted as a tax expenditure. So capital equipment exemptions, exemptions for telecom equipment, exemptions for farm equipment, those are purchases by a final user because the person buying it is the one who's going to use that. Most tax reformers, well, most economists, let me put it that way, who look at the sales tax base broadening would suggest that you don't really want to broaden the base to include all business inputs like this. The Tax Expenditure Review Commission said that they didn't consider these to be tax expenditures. They were sort of suggesting we shouldn't consider these to be tax expenditures when they gave their report. They didn't say to take them out of the report because it's useful information to have, but whether it is useful for base broadening or not is a question. And so you got to be careful. Do you really want to increase the taxes on a lot of business purchases here? Or not. The second thing is the tax expenditure budget includes one entry for selected services, and then it breaks it down to all kinds of detail in accounting and legal and employee services and all this and consumer services. But it's selected. It says selected services, and it excludes some that are pretty important. It does not include medical services. It does not include educational services like tuition payments. It does not include housing services like rents. It does not include construction services by and large. So realize it's limited. So in some ways, there's more in the sales tax area that you could, if you were really trying to go on as much as possible, you could actually do more. Realize that some things are left out. So when you add up the tax expenditures in sales tax, you are missing some things that could, in fact, be included. Governor Ventura, when he proposed sales tax reform, he actually included some of these things. So on the construction side. So realize that there are some things that aren't in the tax expenditure budget that might be possible. So what do the numbers look like then for sales tax? Well, collections of about $5 billion at the bottom. The net revenue line is our collections number forecast for fiscal year 13. This is at 6.875%. Okay, so this is all funds, not just the general fund. And tax expenditures, if you add them up, you get $6.5 billion. That's 130% of collections. So you could more than double the tax base if you tax everything that's shown in the tax expenditure budget. And that would not include inputs that are used up in production by a manufacturer. Those are not considered tax expenditures. So it doesn't include all business purchases, just the ones that are final purchases by a business. If you look at where this money is, though, half the money is in final purchases by business. So if you don't want to do that, you're cutting what you have in half. Okay. So at the bottom, it says base broadening has the potential to reduce rates from 6.875 to below 4.5. I think it's about 4.3 if you just look at the calculation. Even if the base expansion were limited to consumer goods and services and not medical or housing or construction-related, I guess it's medical and housing mainly for them. You could drop the rate to about 4.5%. But that's asking a lot of stuff you may not know, but maybe nobody wants tax. That includes groceries. That includes everything on the list that's in the tax expenditure budget. So, but again, this is one way to use the tax expenditure budget. You can look at these things and say how much rate reduction can we buy holding revenue constant if we broaden the base. So you only get 60% of collections rather than 130%, and so you can't reduce the rate as far. We have a model for sales tax base expansion that was originally produced for Governor Polanyi's 21st Century Tax Reform Commission, and some of you may have seen it, where you basically turn switches on and off, and it calculates how much you could raise or what the revenue neutral rate would be. If anyone is interested in that, we can look at that. But it basically is a model which 21st Century Tax Reform Commission actually went through that model and actually sort of looked at each one and talked about whether that base expansion makes sense, because remember, they wanted to expand the sales tax base to pay for corporate tax reduction. So that model was basically a used a lot by them, even though it doesn't show up in the final report in any particular way. And that is a model that is based entirely really on the tax expenditure budget numbers. Before going there, I guess I want to take Mr. Chair, I'm assuming I've got, can I talk briefly about that other handout? And then we only have a few more slides.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes, sir. The other handout has a lot of numbers on it. And it's just details from these three slides. If I go back to the first income tax slide I had here, this handout, it has tons of numbers on it. The first page is a summary page. If you look at the top of that first page, you have numbers that are basically the same kind of numbers that are on here, I hope. No, it's the wrong one. I'm on corporate, I guess. Okay. Yeah, so you start with, it has the 12.98, it has the 4.7 of tax expenditures, it has the 8.266 of actual collections at the bottom. It has the same information, but on the right-hand side, it actually shows you how much you could drop the tax rate, the percentage drop in tax rate that you could get if you broaden the base to include those things. And the same thing is provided here, but so really this is really the slide again with a few more numbers on the right-hand side. And remember, it's a 6.875% bracket, and you're talking about dropping the rates by that. So from 7.85, if you drop it 2.85, that takes you down to 5.00. So that's the reduction we're looking at. The next page, the next two pages, the next two slides, show all the detail from the tax expenditure budget and do this item by item. It has the same thing sort of at the top, but then it goes through the federal exclusions, the federal exemptions, the Minnesota subtractions, the Minnesota credits. It goes through each and it divides them into items which have timing problems or informational problems. And your little I's and T's down on that page, those identify whether it's an informational problem or a timing problem. And again, this is sort of unofficial by me. This is sort of my way of looking at it. Some of these might be wrong. There might be ways to administer some of these. But this is my attempt, and this is where the numbers come from in the slides, is adding these up. And again, you've got two pages of numbers. But if anybody wants to add up the numbers right there, my only caution is, for each item, it says, it shows how much dollars would be raised, sort of. It's the cost of each one. And that's shown in the tax expenditure budget. The right-hand column is not. That's how much you could reduce the rate and hold revenue neutral. That sort of is the rate. That's the revenue neutral cost of having this exemption rather than a rate reduction. Okay, this is a way to think about it. Those are stated in percentages, so that's a percentage drop from 6.875. Subtract that much, you would get the new rate. But there's a comment up there that says not additive. You can't add these up. If you broaden the base, remember your high school geometry, it's a hyperbola, okay? It comes down. If you double the bracket, you can cut the rate in half. If you double it again, you can't get it to zero. So it's a nonlinear relationship. So you've got to be careful on these. Don't add up. Just be aware of that. The same thing is provided for corporate tax and sales tax with business and consumer and nonprofits and government exemptions broken out differently. So I don't want to say more about this, but that's what it does. It's just the detail behind here. Some people may find this useful. And it sort of gives you how I got the numbers on the slide, because you could not get there necessarily some of those numbers from the tax expenditure budget. You have to know what I've said about some of these in terms of classifications. If anyone has questions on this, I gladly will talk to you individually or take questions now on it. But it's a lot of numbers, and I hand it out with some hesitation. But I think it may prove useful if anybody really wants to think about tax reform in terms of base broadening and lowering the rates. This is probably better to start with than the tax expenditure budget as a document, just because it puts it in a little bit more user-friendly fashion. Okay, just a couple more comments and get back to where I was. Okay, finally, some cautions about the third perspective. What about if we look at this as a menu for tax increases? Let's go through here and look up some things. I need 700. I need to get $70 million. Where can I get it? And you open up tax expenditure budget and you look for something that's going to be about $70 million. You say, well, let's use that one. My cautions for doing that, it's not inappropriate in any strict sense to do that. In other words, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. But the cautions are that you may get misled. Unlike revenue estimates, tax expenditure estimates, they're different in a lot of ways. They ignore the interaction among provisions, so if you were to add up the itemized deductions and you do more than one of them, you're going to be surprised, as I think happened in the House a few years ago where the totals were a lot smaller. They ignore any impact on other taxes, so if you change the vehicle registration tax, they'll have an impact on income tax, and the revenue estimate is going to show that interaction. They're not. Each of these is done separately in the tax expenditure budget, no interactions. And they don't adjust for effective dates. If you make something effective July 1st, as most of you know, you only have 11 months of sales tax collections. You don't have 12 because sales tax collections come in with a one-month lag. So effective dates make a huge difference. For timing issues, there's a much bigger problem. And I don't mention that here, but if it's a timing provision, the revenue estimate will often differ tremendously from the tax expenditure estimate. Because of the way these estimates are done. Neither one's wrong, but it's a different question that's being asked. I can say more if anybody wants to explore it, but on timing issues, you've got to be especially careful. They do not generally take collectability into account, so I actually adjusted for that on this handout for this one I'm going to talk about. But publications, if you were to tax magazine subscriptions, a lot of companies that sell magazines in Minnesota don't have Nexus here, and we wouldn't collect that money from them. Then we're left with collecting it from the individual purchaser through a use tax, a voluntary use tax, and we're not likely to get that money either. So if you do a revenue estimate, you need to take into account Nexus things. In a couple cases like clothing, we've actually taken them into account in our estimates in the tax expenditure budget. But some of them we haven't. I've made an adjustment for the most egregious of those on this detailed page and in these numbers. In some cases, clearly these things are overstated in terms of what you'd really get. And the final thing is, and they're only updated every 2 years. Your revenue estimates change all the time. You only update these every 2 years, and so they can get out of date in a hurry. And finally, remember administrative complexity. Remember timing. Remember informational issues. And remember the issue about business versus consumers if that's something that you are concerned about. So my conclusion is that tax expenditure budget can be useful for those who are interested in budget reform, and that was really the original purpose in some sense for tax expenditure budget was to bring tax expenditures into the same kind of review process that direct expenditures get or appropriations get in budgeting. But that those, and my second comment is just those using the report should read the short introduction and be aware of potential pitfalls when they use the numbers. I do have a couple other slides on here. And these are changes to this edition. We did include digital to goods for the first time, so we had to change our definition of tax expenditure to bring digital goods in, and that may be controversial even in terms of defining it, but it's digital goods, taxing digital goods are there, but that does take the Nexus into account. That number does, that's in the tax expenditure budget, takes Nexus issues into account. That's what we really think is at stake with the Nexus and the de minimis use tax for individuals. The other thing we did was a fairly major change for property tax. We have combined the state tax and the local property tax and consider the tax system, and this is really at the urging, mostly, I think, of the property tax people, Department of Revenue. It also was highly recommended by the Tax Expenditure Review Commission last year. And we show separate tables for the classification impacts of the net tax capacity taxes, the referendum market, it should be market, not merit, referendum market value levies, and the state property tax. And then they show them all together. And we only had the all together table, and sometimes we didn't have the state taxes in before. So this is sort of if you want to look at the effect of classification, you can break it into the classification by tax, by the property tax base, because there are three different bases for the property tax. And it's viewed as one property tax system the way it's done in there now. We also have an online searchable database. It may not be that useful. I can demonstrate it. Very quickly, but this is actually mandated under law for both the budget side and for the tax expenditures. So there is on our website, if you go to the tax expenditure budget, underneath this latest expenditure budget, you can click on, you get an Excel file, and it's set up to just click and sort things from largest to smallest or from the date of enactment or any of those kinds of things. I can demonstrate that very quickly if if you like, but it's pretty self-explanatory when you go on there. I would like to add some columns for the things like potentially administrative problems, maybe what the purpose of this is, although we're a little struggling, but the Tax Expenditure Review Commission really wanted those added, and perhaps adding the tax rate effect that's on this handout might make sense for 1 year, just to show sort of the effect, look at it that way as well, and you could do this. But you can reorder these, you can look at by tax, you can say, I only want federal exclusions in the income tax, et cetera, and it will add the total up at the bottom, although we have a big warning at the bottom saying, be careful, totals don't necessarily add up that. And finally, this is a list of newly enacted tax expenditures since the last budget. But actually, if you look, go in there, you'll find that there are more added to the study because we missed some in past years, particularly a few federal ones. A few of the ones that disappeared were taken out because they're so small and they're federal. And it's so there, you can't really look at the count of tax expenditures and get a good feel. The count went up quite a bit this year, but these are the new ones that were enacted that are important for you since the last study was done. And Mr. Chair, I could take a quick look at that database. Otherwise, that concludes what I have to say today.
Okay. I think we'll get into questions. There's some members that have questions, and if you have questions on the database, that's fine, and Dr. Wills can explain that. But I've got a question on the sheet that you handed out that says gross revenue, revenue net, and tax expenditures. On the pay, you go a couple pages in, individual income tax continued page.
This is
it's on the handout.
On the handout.
Not on the PowerPoint.
And Mr. Chair, I did make some changes this morning. I hope it's right. I should have put preliminary on here probably.
Okay. Just a question here. The first time it says federal deductions other than personal deductions continued, and it says individual retirement accounts. Of course, we know what those are, and it's quite a large number there for 2013. But then line 1.60, you say KEO plans. What? That's a term from the past. I mean, what are you considering KEO plans? Would those be simple SEPs? I mean, you got traditionals above there. Is it 403Bs, 401Ks? What? I mean, maybe to Mr. Michael, aren't KEO plans like a long time ago?
Yes.
And it's a huge number there. It's $100 million. Nobody's doing KEO plans anymore. There's ones out there. Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, yes, KEO plans were a terminology that I don't know whether it actually got into the Internal Revenue Code the way Roth IRAs did. Also, again, named after a member of Congress that sponsored this. That applies to self-employed retirement plans. My guess is, you know, these numbers, I think the department largely uses the federal estimates to determine what they are. And my guess is that this does include what the other kinds of plans that you're referring to, like SEP plans and so forth. I think that the federal estimators lump all of those plans that apply to sole proprietors basically into that one bucket.
So
SEP plans also include employers. You know, you can have, and all self-employed people can have employees that they then have to cover under those plans if they're going to avoid the non-discrimination rule. But I think Paul's probably looking in the book to see if he can find out what's included in
under KEOs. Then you wouldn't have 403Bs or 401Ks. It'd be simple SEPs.
Right.
But those are actually, why wouldn't they be in line 1.59?
I think the individual retirement accounts were always separate from KEO plans. Individual retirement accounts were intended to cover employees initially whose employers did not provide retirement plans, whereas KEO plans covered self-employed individuals. So the distinction is, you know, one employee works for ABC Inc., and ABC Inc. does not have a retirement plan. So when the IRA law was enacted initially, it was designed to let that employee establish their own retirement plan and fund it with deductible contributions. KEO plans were intended to uncover a sole proprietor who wanted to establish a retirement plan for him or herself. And they had much higher limits for contributions than IRAs did, and they also had a percentage limit on it, whereas the IRAs did not have a percentage limit. I mean, this we're going back into the history of the 70s, and Keogh plans actually started in the late 60s.
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, I think that certainly Mr. Michael is correct here. I think that the longer heading in the federal tax expenditure budget is net exclusion of pension contributions and earnings plans for employees and self-employed individuals, and that puts in brackets KEOs. So it doesn't include the IRAs, but includes a much broader group than what we think of just a KEO. So
it's basically
the other deferred.
I mean, you can't even do KEO plans now. Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Wilson, you don't have page numbers on here, but on general sales tax, the exemption for particular goods or services, at the second to the last page.
Representative Paymar, can you please speak in the microphone? We're having trouble hearing you.
Sorry, did you hear that? I don't know what, there's no page numbers on here, but it's under general sales tax. Exemption for particular goods or services, purchases by consumers primarily. There's an accounting services consumer. There's other selected services consumer. What does that mean? Other seems like a. Is that just a. What would those other select services be?
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, in the tax expenditure budget under item 4.19, there's a whole list of personal services or consumer services, and the ones that are identified separately here by number 419A1, I've broken out legal separately, I've broken out repair services, personal care services, funeral services, accounting services, and brokerage and investment counseling services. I can look at that list, but it's all the other ones that are listed in there that are not in that group. It wasn't worth breaking a lot of the smaller ones down on this, or it would have gone to another page, and they're so small they don't really add up to much, but separately. So I just brought them together. In the tax expenditure budget, they're left, all the 4.19 is one line. So I certainly can look it up here, but it's all the ones other than that that are listed under consumer. In the report, and
let me just ask you a question, Mr. Chair. So listening to your presentation last week and this week, it could just be maybe my mood, but what I hear you saying is, this is a review, which is fine, but what I hear you saying, this is what I hear, is that I wouldn't touch anything. You know, be cautious, it's limited, you know, we have to think about conformity, it's complex, don't do this, don't do that. So I hear you saying that kind of the status quo is what we should just stay with.
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, that is certainly not meant to be the message I'm giving. I think those decisions are obviously up to you rather than to me, but I think my cautions here are just simply saying this is a very useful instrument. It's very useful in talking about reform, but I think some people have looked at these as if the numbers, they've looked at them as if, either they've looked at them and said, I don't want to do any of this, or else, the people who want to use it have often had trouble figuring out how to use it. And so we sometimes get people wanting to, they try to expand the base and they include something from the tax expenditure budget that we really can't do. And those don't usually get introduced as bills, but we have had drafts sent to us that have things in them, and we'll get back and say, you know, that isn't really what you think it is, and we don't think you could administer that, or it has major timing problems. Because the tax expenditure budget doesn't say those things in here, and maybe it should just be put in here, my caution is just that. There are some things that you may just not want to do, but if somebody wants to break away from federal depreciation laws, as was done in the early 80s, you can do that. Just recognize that it has some consequences. And there's a lot of base brought in here on There's a lot of base brought in here for corporate tax and sales tax that doesn't have those problems. So, and again, one way to think about the sales tax base broadening is right now businesses pay a fairly large share of purchases by business or a fairly large share of total collections of sales tax. If you were to expand the sales tax base and only expand it to consumer units, some consumer goods, the portion that's paid by business would go down if you drop the rate because they would pay just what they were on what they were paying before, but you would, but they'd be paying a lower rate. So when Governor Ventura proposed reforms, the first round of his reforms, he included quite a few business inputs, he expanded quite a few business purchases, particularly in the services area. And again, my only comment there is just simply that if you think of this as a consumption tax, then you want to think about whether you want to do that. But that's a judgment for others to make. I mean, most economists think of the sales tax as a consumption tax, and so there's always a little concern about some of these business purchases being taxable. And that's partly why some of them are exempt now. Minnesota's moved quite a ways away by exempting more and more capital equipment through time, or at least through refunds exempting it. So that's been the move. But again, those are questions obviously for you to deal with. I'm not trying to make a judgment there, but I don't want people to misinterpret what the numbers mean. And this report has not been changed appreciably in its structure since it was first introduced. And I do think that some of these, the handout I have does give some additional information. We could try to package that inside the report itself, and we may do that the next time around somehow. But I'm really just trying to provide more information about some of these, and they are cautions, but they're not meant to say don't do it. It's just cautions. It's just say don't. I want you to interpret the numbers correctly. That's all. So,
Representative Paymar. Representative Hartman, then Lesch. Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Wilson, I have a question about extending the sales tax to motor fuels. I had a bill a few years back that lowered the sales tax rate to, I think it was 4.5% or 5% by broadening the base. And I had a lot of discussion with fiscal staff about whether or not we could or could not apply the sales tax to motor fuels. And I wonder if there's a constitutional problem with that.
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, the issue there is not, I don't think it's a constitutional problem in terms of whether you can tax it. I don't, if I'm wrong, Mr. Michael, correct me, I don't think there's an issue there. The issue is what can you use it for? And since the excise taxes on motor fuels are I believe, and again, I'll turn to Mr. Michael, but I think they're constitutionally dedicated to transportation or to roads. Because of that dedication in the Constitution, there's a question about whether a sales tax on motor fuels would also be dedicated to, would have to be used for that purpose. So I don't think the issue is can you tax it, but if you're trying to do it in a way to drop a rate and you want to hold the general fund harmless, you may have some problems there. But I don't think there's a constitutional problem with taxing it. It's just a matter of what the money could be used for, and there isn't. If you try to sort of say we're going to put that into transportation and take general fund money out of transportation, there's not really that. I don't think there's enough money in general fund money in transportation to make that switch. And now that motor vehicle registration taxes have been dedicated, motor vehicle sales tax have been dedicated to special funds, it makes it even harder to make that kind of a change. So, but I think that's right. And Mr. Michael, correct me if I'm wrong.
Representative Hartman. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Wilson, on the list that Representative Paymar had cited, that general sales tax expenditure list, I was looking at the list as he was pointing it out, and I see under 4.19A1 legal services, but I see no corresponding line item for illegal services, and I wonder if you forgot that.
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, I think there's some compliance issues on tax and illegal services, but
well, Mr. Chair,
illegal services are not included on the list. You're correct.
Thank you. And if I may, I say this as a member from a district who has a certain measure of, shall we say, underground economy, and And
free of tax.
Free of tax free economy, in fact. You guys should love that, tax free. But I also, you know, it's more expansive than that. We saw the effects recently of certain banks' decisions in international monetary transfers and the implications on certain communities in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and also affecting the banks based upon certain decisions that are made at a national level as to who is and who is not funding terrorism or what have you. And all the decisions that we make around these tables inevitably impact that. So I always like to see that, and I have not seen it around this table when we've discussed it, because people see it as maybe more properly the purview of other committees. But sometimes I think it is the purview of this committee. That's almost true.
Thank you, Representative Blush. Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Wilson, for being here. I'm actually really excited when you come in. I know... To qualify that, Dr. Stinson came to my office for a visit, and he walked in and saw my econ posters, and it was kind of like Mick Jagger walking into a groupie's house, you know, which would be very... So he kind of had that uncomfortable look on his face, like, oh, no, you know. So, but it was really fun to have him. And my question just revolves around some of the nonlinear things that you're looking at, and just the elasticities or the responsiveness to the taxes, because I see taxes as any other thing. It's a price, you know. That said, you know, Adam Smith to Karl Marx knows you're gonna, you know, we all know you're gonna pay taxes. But then my interest revolves around the price elasticity, and then also the income elasticities that take place. And is there a way to do the models allow for that? And I know it's more of a dynamic thing, but you know. And then, so would there be different models surrounding that income, those income, consumption, property, capital gains taxes? So I know this is a many-faceted question, but and how do those interact, or how do you account for those? And I'm just wondering what kind of the trends in the industry are. Thank you.
Dr. Wilson, did you understand any of that? Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bills, I want to see the posters in your office. Maybe they're scary to economists or something. Nope.
You can come by any time you want. So,
Dr. Wilson.
I would start by just saying the tax expenditure budget itself does not address that. So these are not, there are not adjustments in here for behavioral effects at all. Mm-hmm. And that's been the general rule in tax expenditures. Mm-hmm. There are 300, you know, there's so many estimates to be made here that even if you could do it, it's a question whether you'd want to try to do it. The other thing is, if you do several things at once, for example, if you were to expand the tax base and drop the rate, you've got more complexity, because then the rate reduction has some effects as well. But anyway, tax expenditure budget really doesn't address those issues, mm-hmm. except to the extent that we do, in a couple of places, we take some account of some nexus issue. But that's not really behavior. That's really just a collectability issue. On the others, our general rule in the department on revenue estimates, not tax expenditures, but revenue estimates, is that if the tax change is one where we have a good way of knowing, if there's sort of general either history in Minnesota or other states, or there's general knowledge out there that's accepted about the impact of a change. And that applies certainly for cigarette tax. It certainly applies to alcohol taxes. When we change those rates, we bring elasticities into it directly, and the models do that. On the income tax side, Dr. Stinson takes, in capital gains, he has some models that take into account realization decisions. And we have at times at least amended or put an appendage on our estimate dealing with capital gains that sort of says if we did use his model, this is sort of how the results would change. We have not put out estimates that are adjusted that way, but again, we haven't seen those estimates. And again, a lot of that is a timing issue where you just realize sooner or later a lot of the shifts that he's seeing, and he took those out of his forecast centers this time, because when the Bush tax reforms, if they expire, he was showing a big shift in timing, and he took that out this time. So I'm not quite sure how he would do it, but in that case, I mean, capital gains is one where there's some agreement. It's not complete agreement, but there's more. The general question about if you if you put a new top income tax rate on, what will be the behavioral effects? Will people leave the state? How many? What's the impact of that? Will people restructure their income in a way to avoid the higher tax? Is that higher tax net of what you pay less in income tax? At the very high end, there are a lot of studies that try to measure that, but there's not really, it's very hard to come up with a number that we feel real confident about. So, I mean, we do little of it. I think our estimate, we do very little of that. We do it where it's really clear, and we just don't have the resources or we don't have the models that can allow us to do things more complex than that.
Yeah.
What's that, Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I value your answer. It's a very difficult thing to measure how people will respond, and then to also get along, you know, the whole gamut of income and try to calculate how different income levels will respond to certain taxes. It's amazing how it can be done with the we call them, you know, the sin taxes, and it's easier somehow to do that, and I find that fascinating. And so I thank you for your response. I guess just really quickly, in your travels and everything, have you ever come across a great source for kind of like a history of taxes, and you know, has anyone ever gotten into this to the degree of, hey, you know what, here are the studies, and I've searched around, but I just have never found any great culminating work, and I was curious if you had.
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bells, the things I've read, some of the history of economic thought, but that's different. Right. You really want the history of taxes and tax history, and again, I don't have anything particular to suggest. There is a tax historian that writes a lot for Tax Notes, which is the tax magazine, mm-hmm. And may have some publication out there. Mr. Michael may have some suggestions too. I don't have anything I can.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chair. I'm on the right track then, because couldn't find really to lock down something. But I appreciate the opportunity to ask. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bills. Representative Depke.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bills, I'm answering sort of your question, even though Dr. Myron didn't say that I could, but I'm going to make a comment. I spent well over 20 years in the direct marketing industry, and when it comes to consumer purchases, and I'm talking non-essential consumer purchases, the direct marketing industry is a world where customers are captured, average price points are analyzed, how selling prices affect every single purchase, and we've looked at years of the way customers and different income levels work. And the direct correlation that I found in all the years that I was in the industry and looking at pricing and so forth was that if you're going to raise the cost of a purchase by 10%, then you are going to have a direct fall off anywhere from up to 10% in terms of the units sold. So you don't just take something, raise the price on it, which a tax would do, and then just assume that you're going to keep on the same purchases. And so that's a really good, I mean, you know, you could talk to anyone who's in the direct marketing business and get that trade-off, but that's sales and revenue generated is price definitely has an impact. And we heard that testimony in the Nexus, and when we heard people saying that, yes, a 5% tax or a 6% tax that we were charging would reduce or increase, if they didn't have to pay it, increase the number of items sold, but it would decrease it on a proportional level. So there is, but I know that when it comes to property tax, you know, I don't know anything about that, but in consumer purchasing, that's exactly the way it goes.
Okay. We will be getting to the Downey bill in just a bit here, but any other questions for Dr. Wilson? Okay, Dr. Wilson, thank you very much for your presentation. Very informative, and you've given us a lot to think about. Okay, thank you, Dr. Wilson. Representative Downey, if you could please, Representative Downey will move House File 1216. Again, members, we are not voting on this. We will move an amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like, but we will not be taking a final vote. It will stay. This bill will stay in the Tax Committee. Representative Downey moves House File 1216. And so, Representative Downey, I believe you have an amendment. Could you please describe the DE1 amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could move the DE1 amendment. I had a number of kind of isolated changes that I felt were actually more coherent if you just looked at a DE amendment as compared to an individual set of amendments. So I would move the DE1, and if it's all right, Mr. Chair, I'd prefer to maybe just talk about the overall purpose of the bill and then go through the DE1 after that and then answer questions.
Well, Representative Downey, would you like the DE1 amendment moved now so it's
Please.
So
yep.
that we're talking in general? Okay.
Yep.
All in favor say aye.
No.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill as amended. Representative Downey, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that I actually had as an amendment 2 or 3 years ago in Tax Committee. Representative Loeffler offered a, from my perspective, somewhat helpful amendment to my amendment. It never went on, and I've continued to have the same discussion year after year in the Taxes Committee about the language around this tax expenditure report, and from my perspective, the confusion it creates. And so the bill actually attempts to clear some of that up. It creates a tighter piece of language in statute, and I think from a terminology standpoint makes it eminently more understandable to the average person, and frankly I'm guessing to most of the Tax Committee members, myself included. And I want to thank Dr. Wilson. When we had our exchange, when he first presented his materials, he asked if I might be willing to put together a slide that I would suggest inserting into his presentation to address some of my concerns. So I actually sat down to do that, and unfortunately it ballooned into like 12 slides, only one of which I might actually suggest adding into his presentation. But I thought I'd walk through this. I'll do it very quickly and walk through the bill real quick, and then we can have some discussion. So what I did is I just went out and looked at Merriam-Webster and looked at what the definition of spending and expenditure is, because when I got down here, I had no clue what a tax expenditure was when I first heard the word. I've asked literally dozens of people in my district and in my family, if I used the word tax expenditure, what would you say that is? And the only consistent answer I've gotten, other than a puzzled look, is, well, that's when I write my tax check to the state or the federal government. And that's kind of what I thought too. Just naturally, when you think of the definition of the word spend, the definition of the word expenditure, you're talking about somebody actually writing a check, somebody having possession of something or being the owner of something, and then dispersing from that. And so what we've got is, I think, a mismatch between the average citizen's terminology and this government term that we've somehow adopted called tax expenditure. So I did a quick search and was able to find not only our statutory language, which is at the top of this slide here, which describes tax expenditures as a gross income definition, deduction, exemption, credit, or rate for certain persons, types of income, transactions, or property that results in reduced tax revenue. And so I did a broader search, and it turns out that the CBA has from the U.S. Congress has a definition that talks about revenue losses. The Tax Policy Center has another one that talks about revenue losses. And so I think, even though we put this label of expenditure on it, really the more common sense definition is that we're talking about lost revenue or reduced tax revenue. And so the title tax expenditure, I think, is extremely misleading. And so it isn't just tax expenditure as a term. There's more common usage of it, and we start to drift into this term of using spending when we talk about expenditures. And if I apply just a common sense definition of expenditure or spending, I think the only part of the tax expenditure report that really technically falls in that category where the state is writing a check would be a refundable tax credit. All of the other ones are really just some kind of a reduction in the tax liability owed. And so I would grant that tax expenditure is probably a fair term for those refundable tax credits which appear in the tax expenditure report, and probably not for the rest of them, at least for the average person, myself included. And what I've seen in the 3 years that I've been here, and this is why I always pipe up when we get into this topic, is that You know, while tax expenditure is kind of a foreign term to most people, confusing in terms of public understanding, when we start to slip into the term spending and talk about tax expenditures as being government spending, I think we've slipped into a political bias, and frankly, I think the use of tax expenditures is abused a bit politically. And lo and behold, as I was looking up the definitions of tax expenditures, I came across a federal report from the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress. This is back in 1999. So we've kind of slipped into this traditional nomenclature here where tax expenditures is supposedly a commonly accepted term among tax professionals. But even at the U.S. congressional level, there's a ton of debate about whether this makes sense or not. It calls tax expenditures quite controversial. It's controversial because tax payments are viewed from the viewpoint of the government as opposed to the viewpoint of taxpayers. They're viewed as depriving the government of its rightful revenues. These lost revenues are regarded as properly belonging to the federal government in the first place. It contradicts with common sense perceptions, and you can read on. And what I found is, wow, lo and behold, there's some people that think like I do and don't just accept this common tax professional nomenclature of tax expenditure, which maybe a few thousand tax professionals and PhDs and economists might understand, but the rest of us really don't. And so it's not, in my mind, as commonly understood and accepted as we might think as we discuss it here in tax committee. And so the alternative perspective that I wanted to bring, and Dr. Wilson can evaluate whether to include this in his presentation or not, but I don't see any way you can call the absence of a tax, either in part or in whole, state spending. You can call it a revenue loss, you can call it a lack of tax revenue, you can call it a lot of things, but it's not spending. The state is not writing a check, except again in the case where I would grant a refundable tax credit, could in fact result in the state writing a check, in which case it is an expenditure, and you could then, I think, equate it with other direct spending. So this premise that we betray, I think, is less about factual accuracy and understanding and more about politics. And it belays this premise that somehow the state budget is the starting point for every tax discussion rather than the entire system within which the economic and social system that we deal with, you know, in a broader context in the private sector. And it also betrays this premise that somehow all revenue, all income and capital and assets are somehow the right of the state to capture as revenue. That seems to be the fundamental starting point, and I personally, I don't like that bias. And so there is a legitimate policy discussion that we can have, and I would grant you that. You know, in a revenue-neutral way, are we better off reducing an overall rate and eliminating the reductions and the lost revenue from the expenditures? Are the particulars of the tax relief for the expenditures that we're providing, are they actually good policy or not? I mean, these are legitimate discussions to have. But I would argue that outside of the constitutionally authorized roles of the state, there should always be a preference for tax policies that allow people to keep their income, their capital, and their assets. And it seems like the very discussion we always have around tax expenditures originates with the reverse. This is getting a little far afield, maybe, but I think it's really true. Somebody handed me a business book, I don't know, 12, 15 years ago, called Barbarians to Bureaucrats, and it was a lesson in organizational rise and fall and pitfalls to avoid as a business person trying to build an optimally performing organization. And it was written by somebody who had chronicled the rise and fall of civilizations. And as you look down this kind of sequence, you see how organizations, and based on the model of civilizations, what happens to them as they rise and fall. And in their early stages, there's a dynamism, there's an entrepreneur, there's a vision, there's some sense of inspiration and moving forward, perhaps a grand plan. And then, in his terms, there's some barbarians that are actually willing to go out and make it happen, put the ruts in the prairie, build the forts, do all the things that we did in the early years of our founding. And then after that, you start to build and explore, and you take that Louisiana Purchase, and you divide it into states, and you build it out, and all these good things that happen. And then along the way, you got to have some administration, some way to manage that complex. But what happens to civilizations and organizations is that they slide into a bureaucratic mode, where the organization exists as much to feed itself as it does to focus on the customers or the people for which it was originally intended to serve. And in the most extreme case, it becomes an aristocracy, where that entire bureaucracy exists just to serve a small number of people at the top of it. And I would argue that much of the discussion we're having politically here, nationally and here in our state, is about how far do we want to go down this chain. And one of the things that happens with bureaucracies is they start to build a set of terminology and a language that nobody else understands. It's incoherent to its customers. It's incoherent to its people. The average person cannot understand what it's doing, and it thus seals itself from the will of the people, in this case, or the will of the customers. And that's where the decline starts. And so I would argue, this may be a grander point than people are willing to think about or grant me, but I'd argue that this tax expenditure report is just one symptom of the bureaucratic morass that we keep creating down here, and that makes our government so unintelligible to people. So my bill, 1216, attempts to differentiate from, and it's a fairly technical differentiation, but I think it's important and it would actually make more sense to people, to differentiate on this tax expenditure report things that are selective tax relief, i.e. a loss of revenue, clearly, versus those things that actually technically are tax expenditures. And so I think with this change that we'd have terminology that's more commonly understood, we'd actually enhance the tax policy decision-making debate. It's a small step. I think it makes the government more understandable, and I think it helps us avoid this slide into a bureaucratic mess that nobody from the outside looking in can even understand. And I know Commissioner Franz was here yesterday, and he presented his information about the tours that he's been taking and the presentations that he's been giving, and we all rightfully complimented him on that effort. But it was really amazing to me on his slide about tax expenditures, where it's called Minnesota's Hidden Spending. And so this is just a classic example, right? So we've now had 17 forums around the state with the Commissioner of Revenue talking about spending, when not a single dollar for most of it is actually being expended or spent by the state. And on top of that, it's hidden, as though there's something sinister about the way we've structured this selective tax relief. Then he has another page that talks about how we could collect another 40 cents on the dollar if we simply avoided this hidden, sinister spending that we're doing through the tax code. No mention of all that we could actually reduce rates if we eliminated the expenditure. All about capturing more revenue. And you know what? I will grant, you know, the people on the other side of the aisle don't like to lose the revenue. Fair enough. People on the Republican side of the aisle want to cut the spending and reduce the taxes. Fair enough. But I think the bias in the fundamental language of this report and everything that comes out of the bureaucracy is unfair, and it's more political than factual. So my bill attempts to address that in a couple of key ways. And if I could just walk through the bill language, I'll stand for questions. Or if somebody wants to come down and make a point, I'm glad to have a broader discussion too. So to the DE amendment that we adopted on the way in here, what I'm doing is actually tightening up the language on line 1.8, where it seems that statute already talks about selective tax relief versus tax expenditures. So I'm just capitalizing on that terminology and and saying that as we go forward and produce this report, that we would group the report into two sections. The first, which would be this selective tax relief, which is really just truly a loss of revenue or the absence of taxation in a selective way, versus those things that are then tax expenditures. So if you go all the way down to the bottom, it talks about the definition of selective relief versus an expenditure. And I'm relying pretty exclusively on the fact that a refundable tax credit, as defined in many places throughout statute, would fit the category of expenditure, rightfully so, and everything else is simply a loss of revenue and is more accurately captured in the selective relief category, selective tax relief category, as compared to a tax expenditure. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm glad to answer questions or have a broader discussion, and I appreciate the chance to put my opinions out there and see if we can't maybe take a crack at this one area of the system that is so hard to understand for people.
Thank you for the presentation, Representative Downey. Representative Blesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have, has the amendment been passed out?
No.
I have, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, I have, I hope we'll take as a friendly amendment because, you know, I think it's a worthwhile topic of conversation. Like you said, so much of our policy here is governed by the terminology that we use. The linguists would have a field day with respect to what we call a tax expenditure, whether it's tax relief, or for those of many of my constituents and people around Minnesota who are having a major problem right now with targeted tax relief, which is essentially corporate welfare. If you are at the upper end of the income strata, you have the opportunity for massive, quote-unquote, tax relief that everyone else doesn't have the opportunity to, which the rest of us end up having to pay for, because at some point that money just doesn't grow on trees and we as individuals can't print more of it. So my amendment adds in a third category to this report, which would be the corporate welfare provision. And it states, borrowing from your language, that if you are a subchapter C corporation or pass-through entity such as subchapter S, and you have available to you special tax benefits that average people don't have, then that gets reported as well. So in keeping with your endeavor to more correctly characterize the language we use with respect to tax expenditures, I hope you'll just accept this as a friendly amendment.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, I would argue against the amendment. I think the separation of the tax expenditures from the refundable tax credits will actually pretty clearly highlight where corporate welfare is occurring, and I don't disagree with Representative Lesch that there's plenty of it. But if we were to go with his amendment and point out corporate welfare, we'd have to all of a sudden isolate every potential entity out there. You could even think of organized labor and other kind of friendly amendments to your amendment that could be made, and now all of a sudden we're down in a soup that I don't think we want to get into. So I'd argue against the amendment and just leave the categories as I've defined them.
Representative Anderson, to the amendment. Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Representative Lesch for trying to work with the committee to get to a more comprehensive and neutral position on the terminology we use. I think he takes us in an appropriate direction. I'm struck, though, that what's missing in your amendment and what's missing in Representative Downey's bill, and perhaps we could, after we're done with this, perhaps, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure, work on another amendment. We're lacking recognition of special interests, that tax expenditures exist because special interests come and either say, I'm engaged in a behavior and I want you to cut my taxes for engaging in that behavior, or I want to engage in a behavior and I want you to cut my taxes for engaging in that behavior. I want to buy a house and I want you to subsidize that through the mortgage interest credit because I want to be ahead of the renters. And so we, you know, interest groups come up. We're all part of them. We've all worked with them, you know, bipartisanly, but we're lacking any discussion of special interest groups and the roles that they play and how these tax expenditures, as with the corporate welfare, respond to the lobbying of special interest groups. And then I'd also just challenge Representative Downey. You said, well, Republicans like to cut spending, and a couple of the major media outlets today have a report on how the major GOP presidential candidates' tax and budget proposals would actually balloon the federal debt, and that they're not fiscally responsible, and that your party has been very effective in having a brand at being fiscally responsible without practicing fiscal responsibility over the years. And I credit you with attempting to keep the brand alive, even though the reality for middle-class Americans who are trying to struggle through the economy that your party's fiscal irresponsibility created and regulatory responsibility aren't finding. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion to the Lesh Amendment. Representative Lesh has moved the H1216A1 Amendment. Further discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I realize it's not our intent to take a vote on the bill today, as I noticed from the agenda, but I did think it was important to bring this up, and Representative Downey, this is only partially tongue-in-cheek. I think it would be worthwhile to actually have the conversation you brought up, whether you want to bring up organized labor. I would take that as a friendly amendment to this. I think that if we want to highlight who's getting the special tax benefits, I think it's important to point everyone out. That's probably only the tip of the iceberg of who's getting the benefits. And I'm sure you can imagine that it's probably the people that I hang out with more that aren't getting most of them. But I think it's worthwhile. So would you, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, I'd be more than willing to add in your language, Representative Downey, as a friendly amendment to include organized labor in that.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, I use that as an example of the almost infinite number of specialized categories you could get into. And to Representative Dabney's point and yours as well, Representative Lesh, on line 1.12, and this is existing statute, I'm not adding this, line 1.12 through line 1.15, the expenditure report as it exists today already is intended to provide a description of the objectives of the expenditure, whether it's effective in accomplishing those objectives. And there is a paragraph or two of description on each of the expenditures in the report. So in my view, this broad categorization allows us to understand what's actually going on far better, and the detailed descriptions of each one-off expenditure, I think, are plenty able to provide the kind of parting of the clouds at a more detailed level by group, as you're suggesting. So I think we accomplished what you're asking for already, and I would urge a no vote on the amendment.
Representative Lesh, you do have the floor, but before we go to your next question, is there anyone from the audience that would wish to testify for or against the Lesh amendment? Okay, Representative Lesh. Whenever I ask about my bills, there's a whole bunch of people who come testify against them. You know, Representative Lesh, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And no, I obviously it wasn't simply a rhetorical device here. I think it is important to have a broad conversation about not just whether or not we're getting taxed in Minnesota, but who's getting taxed and who's getting the benefits of that. So with that, I would withdraw the amendment until we are actually in position to vote on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Any other questions for Representative Downey? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Downey. I mean, I'm someone who likes plain language in our statutes, and I think you ought to be able to read through the statutes and not have to sit through all the PowerPoints that we have the advantage of to understand them. And so I'm concerned about a couple of different things in this draft. One is to take away the statement of purpose. I think it actually does introduce to the lay reader what we're talking about, and I think that works. And I think it's also important for us to remember that we, on a, as I recall, bipartisan basis, adopted a bill that I think, or an amendment, I'm not sure how it was presented, by Representative Liebling, but it's in statutes right now that says every time we pass a new tax expenditure, we have to have a purpose statement. So we have to be honest with the public about what we're intending to do or what we expect to achieve out of that tax expenditure, and then we can be held accountable and evaluate whether we're achieving that purpose. And as this is drafted, I think that it would take away all the purpose requirement for non-refundable exemptions, and I think that actually would be stepping away from the kind of transparency and clarity that I think the public deserves, no matter whether you support a particular tax expenditure or not. I think you should be clear in presenting it to us and to the public about what the purpose is of that. And so I hope that before we act on this finally, that we will deal with that. The other thing is, I think the word relief is actually not a neutral term. I think it has a certain connotation, and I would, in the wordsmithing that we go forward, I would like to substitute break, because I think everyone understands what a tax break is, and it can be your mortgage interest deduction, it can be, any kind of other of the long list that we've gone through, but I think the public actually understands what a tax break is. Tax relief sounds like politician speak, and I think we ought to avoid that when we can.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Before we go to Representative Carlson, is there anyone that would like to testify from the audience regarding the Downey bill as amended? Okay, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I actually was going to raise a couple of different questions, but the statement of purpose, it referred, just to expand a little bit on what Representative Loeffler was saying, and what I noticed was achieved both by direct expenditure of government funds and by granting of special or selective tax relief. And by changing that and striking that, I think it does greatly change the context of this bill so that the public really understands what's being talked about by what we today call tax expenditures at any rate. But I did have, that was just a follow-up to hers. I would hope that you'd reconsider at least the retention of the state statement of purpose. The website you alluded to, Representative Downey, who put together the website? I didn't quite follow when you said you were doing your research, you discovered this website or something, and who was the group or government agency, if it was a government agency? Where did that website development come from, do you know?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would have to go back and redo my Google search. I think I just did tax expenditure definition or something, and there were a handful of definitions that came up that more or less confirmed the definition that's in our state statute, and I think I attribute them in the PowerPoint. The first one was from the Congressional Budget Office, I think, so it's the federal definition. And then the other one was from some Tax Policy Institute, which was a combination of Brookings and somebody else. Actually, I could probably... Urban Institute and Brookings. So those are out there. It's not like some website where somebody built a site with the definitions. I just happened to find these two definitions, which very closely correlated to ours, so I included them to show the common. And the common theme that I saw in them was that we're really talking about reduced tax revenue and revenue losses, and the word spending actually never even appears in the tax expenditure definitions that are out there, and that's the common colloquial use of the term when we get into political discussions.
Representative, he wasn't from ALEC, was it?
I'm not familiar with ALEC, Mr. Chair. Okay.
That, Mr. Chairman, that was not the purpose of my question. Where I was headed with that, which is my next follow-up, and you can see it on my note, was I was interested in that source of the definition and the discussion because of other states. And if we would be going in a different direction than other states do, and a lot of what we discuss in the Tax Committee and other legislative committees as well is how we sometimes compare with one state or another. So ALEC wasn't on my mind, but if it was, I guess we should know that. But my point was going to be how do other states define tax expenditures, and would we be, with your definition, going in a different direction, and would it become more difficult to compare Minnesota with other states? And maybe that could be a question that the revenue department.
No, that's a very good question. Mr. Michael, or how, with what Representative Downey is trying to do in House File 1216 is amended, even before this, I guess the question is, how do other states define a tax expenditure that we have defined now? How do other states have, is that the question, Representative Carlson?
Basically, for comparative purposes, is there an issue there if we define it differently than what other or most states do? That's why I was interested in what the website was.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, many other states do have tax expenditure budgets, but I must confess I've never looked at them to sort of determine what kinds of definitions they use. My instinct is that they likely use something very similar to the federal and what we do. Dr. Wilson, who I know has been involved with the Tax Expenditure Commission, may have done, you know, more looking at what other states do and might have a better fix on if some of them I'm sure some of them have slight differences from the way we define things, but I don't know if any of them make this distinction, particularly between refundable and non-refundable provisions.
That's a very interesting question. Dr. Wilson, could you maybe help us out a little bit here? Dr. Wilson, to the Carlson question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Carlson, states do define tax expenditures in different ways. Most states follow the federal definitions closely on income tax and corporate tax, but sales tax states differ greatly. Some states, I think there may be some states out there that actually do refer to their report as a tax relief report. I'm not completely sure about that. But a lot of them will include something like the exemption from sales tax for inputs used in the manufacturing process is actually listed in those in their comparable tax expenditure budgets. The one thing the tax expenditure budget, the term tax expenditure does do is it says these are deviations from some standard, and so states that refer to tax relief tend to include a lot more stuff in some of their reports because they're including everything that could be thought of. For example, the itemized deduction for business interests, the itemized deduction for miscellaneous business expenses. We don't count those as tax expenditures because we view that as a good way to measure business income. That's an adjustment to business to true income. And so we don't count that as tax expenditure. I don't know if that's a tax relief or not. It certainly cuts people's taxes. So I think that I don't think the language here would necessarily change anything we're doing in that definition. It wouldn't force us to change it. But the term tax expenditure has in some ways there's more of a tradition in terms of what it means than the term tax relief. And I do think some of the states that do tax relief, they just throw everything into the report. Anything that's listed in the law as an exemption or something just gets thrown in. So maybe that difference. I would say that the term tax expenditure, the federal tax expenditure budget does separate the refundable portion of refundable credits. I don't know if the entire refundable credit would be, but the refundable portion of refundable credits, the part that gets your tax below zero, they do break that out, and we could break that out and handle it different. They refer to it as they use the term outlay for that. I'm a little troubled with the use of tax expenditure. I hate to redefine a term in a way that no one else uses the term. So I agree that taking that, I mean, in some ways, if you don't like tax expenditure, you just throw the term out completely. I think there's a little more confusion brought about by using the term, but defining it in a way that is not compatible with how it's defined elsewhere. So in some ways, we could sort of do what you're asking for, but in some ways, tax expenditure is a defined term that is defined the same way basically everywhere, and we would be deviating greatly from that. But that's not the report. That's just the
Mr. Chair.
Term. Representative Wardlaw.
To Representative Carlson's question, I think this question, Representative Carlson's question, actually illustrates the point that Representative Downey is trying to make here pretty well. As Representative Downey, thanks to Representative Downey for bringing this bill forward and this discussion forward, because I think it's very, very important. Around here, I don't think we talk enough about the larger picture, and we get caught in the details and the weeds. But looking to other states and seeing what they define tax expenditure to be would be not a very useful exercise if we are indeed going down on Representative Downey's slide, barbarians to bureaucrats. If we're reaching the bottom of the slide here and all of the states are becoming more bureaucratic and more perhaps even aristocratic, and the definitions and terms that state governments are using across the country are problematic because they obfuscate and confuse and hide what's really going on and are contrary to common sense, then maybe Minnesota could take a new path forward here and help turn the country around by leading and deviating from the practice of other states, which is going down the path toward which are going to put down the wrong path. So this is a very refreshing discussion, and I think that it's important. And also Representative Loeffler's comments earlier with regard to tax break versus tax relief really shows the fundamental divide that we're getting at here, that the people own wealth and the government taxes that wealth, and that tax is a burden and is used for particular purposes. And when we choose not to tax, either selectively or across the board, the wealth of the people, that is relief to the people because it relieves the burden. it's not a break, it's relief, because the people, not the government, own the wealth. So it's a good philosophical discussion to have, and I think that words have meaning and ideas have consequences, and thank you, Representative Downey, for bringing this forward.
Chairman, you still have the floor. I think I had the floor, and the comments by Representative Wardlow go far beyond the point that I was trying to make. I was trying to get an understanding of how necessary it might be to have a similar definition to what other states use. And I think, without putting words in Dr. Wilson's mouth, he pointed out that there would be, with the definition of tax expenditures per se, we would be the outlier, you know, that we would be doing something quite different from what other states do. We can have a philosophical debate, I suppose, some other day if that's part of it, but I just wanted to understand, for comparison purposes, what this change might mean.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. And my ALEC comments were not intended to suggest that you were going down that road, so I apologize for that inference, Sarah. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, okay.
Representative Downey.
If I could just briefly respond to Representative Carlson and Loeffler's request to look at the statement of purpose. I think back when I originally drafted this bill, we were moving away from purpose statements in law. So I think the striking of that was maybe more reflective of that than trying to get away from one. So if that would be helpful to reauthor something that would accommodate the intention of my bill but still leave a purpose statement in there, I'm glad to do that. And this question about whether we do something different than other states actually goes way deeper than just the grouping and kind of terminology headings. I mean, the fundamental assumption on how you arrive at the base from which you're going to determine whether something is an expenditure or not is a huge question. We do not include the difference between our top income tax rate of 7.85 and our lowest income tax rate of 5.35. We don't show that as a negative expenditure for the additional burden on the higher end earners, and we also don't show it as an expenditure for the amount of tax that we would collect at the 7.85% rate if it were applied across all categories. To Representative Bill's point, we don't include any other kind of economic implications or derived costs to revenue or spending at the state by virtue of the policy. We only look at it in one direction. And that, I think, is something that's a deeper question where you really would be kind of, if I tried to hard code that into law and change the way the base is actually derived before the expenditures are calculated, we really would be way out of the mainstream. And so I don't think I'm not going that deep. I would like to, frankly, but I wouldn't even know how to go about doing that. So suffice it to say right now, this is just about organizing the report, changing its title, and making it more understandable to us and the public.
Thank you very much, Representative
Carl. I was just going to say, Representative Downey is taking the Peter Watson approach with statement of purposes. I had more than one bill that I sent over to the Senate that would come back with a minor amendment and the recommendation of Peter Watson. For the newer members, he was Senate counsel, striking the statement of purpose. I never did ask for a conference committee on that question, but there was a history of the Senate there.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Thank you, Representative Downey. Members, we will be getting an agenda out on your emails as far as next week. With that, good government all the time. We are adjourned.